Hello and welcome to this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast. Psychologist Mark van Vught and journalist Anjana Ahuja have collaborated on a book called Selected: Why Some People Lead, Why Others Follow, and Why It Matters. Amid the plethora of books on leadership on offer, this one stands out for being focused on insights about the prehistory of our species, those behaviours that were hardwired into us hundreds of thousands of years ago, when we dwelt in small bands on the savannah with informal leadership structures. But it also focuses on the implication of that legacy in the modern world. When I spoke to Mark on the phone, I wanted to know why leadership developed in the first place. What evolutionary advantage did it offer?
What we argue in the book is that leadership is a solution to problems of coordination between individuals. So when a group of individuals must decide where to go or what to do, whether to wage war with another group or not, it helps if one or more individuals take the initiative and others follow, because it preserves group unity, it preserves consensus within the group, and so helps the group to survive and thrive in a harsh environment, which our ancestral environment no doubt was.
And you see a decisive moment in human development as being the point at which agriculture and with it sedentary societies come along. So what did that mean for the way in which leadership operated for human society?
So what we argue based on actually a lot of findings is that leadership was quite egalitarian in our ancestral past. That is to say that we probably evolved in small groups, small communities in which leadership was informal and there was really not a designated person to have authority over others. And that served us well. And power differences were really very small, because if people didn't like each other, they simply went away. Now, that changed with the agricultural revolution, because our ancestors got a more sedentary lifestyle where communities were formed, houses were built, and that meant that individuals could accumulate a lot more resources, which they could store, and so they got wealthier. Some individuals got wealthier than others, and with that also power differences emerged. And the problem was, for those who didn't have much power or resources, the have-nots, so they couldn't simply move away. So they were stuck with the individuals that had authority over them. And I mean, usually that probably went fine, but sometimes more despotic, tyrannical leaders emerged, which didn't serve the group very well or the community, but served themselves very well.
It kind of, as you say, allows the emergence of despotism and nepotism and corruption. Those are all things which a more hierarchical, sedentary society allows to come into being.
Yeah. But obviously, the blueprint of that tendency to dominate and exploit was already there. It is part of our primate nature, but it got unleashed in the agricultural revolution.
And a key part of your argument is that these characteristics of what we look for in a leader were laid down in a very different social setup, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. And therefore, there's a mismatch between what we're looking for and what the demands of a modern, complex, much more diverse society actually makes of us.
The mismatch is, I mean, it's obviously not everywhere, because on the whole, I mean, history shows that we've been sort of pretty good at selecting otherwise, we wouldn't have thrived as a species, I think. But it is true to say that certain biases that are still around in the way we select our leaders, such as our preference, for example, for taller, masculine leaders, it's probably something that was shaped in our ancestral past. And today, we can't really understand why we still have such preferences. I mean, why in an American presidential election would voters time and again vote for the taller candidate? There's not really a rational reason for that, unless one assumes that we're really seeing these leaders through the eyes of our ancestors, in which something like height was quite a significant indicator of the way a leader would be successful.
Now, how then do we explain the fact that in present-day Europe, we've got Sarkozy in France, who's a small man, we've got Berlusconi in Italy, and we've got Angela Merkel in Germany, who's a woman? I mean, all three of those seem to kind of go against what you're arguing our bias would make us favor.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is that these biases that we have will increase the chances, obviously, of somebody getting into a leadership position, all else, all other things being equal. That's hardly ever the case. So there are very different reasons, also some of which are based on our evolved functions of leadership, why we might select certain leaders. So, for example, one of the things we find time and again in our studies is that there seems to be a niche for a female or feminine leadership, particularly when a country or a group or community needs cohesion and unity, and sort of peacekeeping or peace restoring is the main issue. So there are many different reasons for picking our leaders, and that sometimes means that there is a sudden niche for a leader who is a little bit unusual in some ways, a female leader, or sometimes a short leader.
You talk about experiments in which participants are asked to select a leader from a choice of two, depending on whether the imagined situation is one of wartime or one of peacetime. And what kind of differences does that throw up in the choice of leadership?
All right, so one of the consistent findings of our research is that when we give participants faces of potential leaders, and these faces are actually morphed faces, they're not real persons, but they're, as it were, contrived faces. And then when we vary these faces in terms of the masculinity of their facial appearance or the femininity, then what you get is that depending on the scenario in which these participants, they are mock voters, or they're voters in a mock election, depending on the situation that they find themselves in, they develop preferences for either a masculine-looking leader at times of war and a feminine leader at times of peace. We've also morphed the ages of the faces, and what you see then, very interesting, is that at times of transition, when give participants the scenario that the country is undergoing change and that they must adjust to change, new technologies, etc., that at that time they develop a preference for a younger-looking leader, whereas an older-looking leader is preferred at times of stability.
So far we've been talking about leadership, but obviously the obverse of that is if one person is leading, then there have got to be lots of people who are following, and you describe followership as the default setting for the human psyche. Now, I can see why leadership has its attractions. You talk about sex, salary, and status as the attractions that go along with the position. Tell me what the attractions would be for followership, since that's the position most of us tend to be in most of the time.
Well, we've identified three very deep-seated motivations for becoming a follower. One fairly sort of selfish or opportunistic reason is that if you want to become a leader one day yourself, it's actually good to be following a leader closely so that you could, as it were, learn the trade almost as an apprentice. But there are other reasons as well, and they're also very fundamental. One is that follow other individuals if we're uncertain what to do. There's lots of situations in which it's ambiguous what the most appropriate action would be. For example, in an emergency situation, do we go left or right? If we see an individual moving left and we do not know what to do, we'll tend to follow that individual. And that also makes a lot of sense. It's called conformity, if you like. And then a third reason is because we want to fit in, follow an individual, because following an individual or being a follower makes us being accepted by the group. And deviancy and social exclusion from the group were really not very attractive propositions, especially in ancestral times.
Now, I also wanted to ask you about what you call the dark triad, which is a trio of characteristics which mark out leaders like, let's say, like Hitler or Stalin. What is going on there in their psychological makeup, and why do they tend to succeed, albeit for a short time?
Well, what we've identified is a set of personality traits that psychologists often call the dark triad. It's a combination of three traits that are considered to be quite bad, if you like, narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism. And what that combination of traits gives you is an individual who can be quite charming at the outset, in first interaction, but has a hidden agenda, which is often dark and out there to exploit you. But because it's not so obvious from the first contact, because they are very charming individuals, and they're also very self-absorbed, status-driven, etc., they might end up as leaders of groups, particularly groups that have come together very recently, in which there is not a clear hierarchy already. These individuals are highly motivated to get into that position. Once they are in that position, they can use it to their own advantage, often by very cunningly manipulating other individuals, believing that they have the best interests of the group at heart, etc., until eventually they're found out or they contribute to the collapse of the group.
And you say people who have this personality combination tend to have quite a high degree of reproductive success. So it is absolutely true that power is an aphrodisiac, irrespective of whether one is a bad leader or a good leader.
Yes, I think that is true. I mean, it is a, if you like, a sort of short-term strategy to increase your reproductive opportunities. And that seems to be working quite well. I mean, in sexual relationships, women often find these types of men quite attractive. And as followers, we also find these leaders quite attractive. But their appeal is short-lived, but it's just long enough for them to reap the reproductive benefits of this style of leadership.
So if we have these inbuilt, hardwired biases, which have been created by our evolutionary distant past, I think you say pinstripes concealing our ancient brains, can we at least correct some of the biases where they're taking us in the wrong direction, so we don't just go for the candidate who's tall and got good teeth, and actually, you know, make a more reasoned, rational judgment about who would make a good leader?
Well, I think, I mean, first of all, it is good, and that's also what I think the book purports to do, is to make people aware that these biases do exist and that they are systematic. They're not random. I mean, the problem, I think, obviously, is that, like, when we educate people that these biases do exist, what happens is that, particularly in the modern media age, leaders can portray themselves in certain ways using all kinds of technologies to make them look more appealing, more attractive, even taller. I'm reminded of stories that we've also quoted in the book of Berlusconi and Sarkozy delivering speeches while standing on platforms. So there are all kinds of ways in which aspiring leaders can manipulate this kind of information. But it's also our task, I think, as scientists, but particularly as policymakers and journalists, if you like, to point people in the direction of these biases and try to make people aware of them.
As far as the position of women goes, I mean, we, in the last 100 years, we have travelled quite far, but you know, we still have a long way to go, don't we? You make the point that male CEOs are not interviewed and asked about what it's like to be a male CEO, whereas women still are. So it's still, however enlightened we may think we are, it's still seen as something rather exceptional, isn't it?
Yes, that is true. And again, what we argue is that this is not just a product of socialization or culture, if you like. I mean, there is a sort of deep-seated suspicion, I would argue, against female leaders. But also opportunities, as we argue in the book, for female leadership. Remember that leadership in ancestral environments was informal. It was not one individual who would make all decisions on behalf of the group. And in certain situations, a female or a feminine leader would have been likely to emerge, such as in situations in which there are conflicts between members of the same community or tribe. In those situations, we argue, there would have actually been a niche for female leaders to emerge. The same with the role of females in cementing alliances between groups. The modern diplomat, if you look, for example, at the foreign secretaries in the U.S. Over the past decades, they've all been women. Again, there is a niche here for female leadership. We also know that if you look at the abilities and talents and skills of men and women, then women tend to be stronger in empathy and verbal skills. Again, by highlighting those virtues, if you like, we might be able to overcome these ancestral biases and select more women into these positions. Problem, again, is that they will be probably judged more harshly when they find themselves in positions of CEOs, etc.
Mark van Vught. The book which he co-wrote with Enyana Ahuja is called Selected, and is out now in paperback. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Podcast, but go to blackwell.co.uk and find out more, not only about this book, but about several million others. And the podcast tab on the homepage will take you to an archive of over 100 podcasts. I hope you can join me again soon for another in-depth author interview, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.